Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live 101.3 KPCG online, kpcg.fm. Hopefully you're having a great Monday. Coming up on today's edition of Trumpet Radio Live, there is a dam in California that may give way. 200,000 people told to evacuate. We'll have details about that. Awkward moment at USTA, that's the United States Tennis Association tournament. They accidentally sang the Nazi-era German national anthem, and that bothered a few people. Also, President Trump set to meet Canada's Trudeau at the White House today. That should be an interesting meeting. We have details about that and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us today, this Monday edition of Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG online, kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. We have a cloudy Monday here in Edmond, Oklahoma, and some rain on the way. So I'm looking forward to it. We are dry, Grant, very dry. There were fires yesterday. Probably 15 miles from here. And I turned on the basketball game that was on Sunday afternoon, and they did the double boxes where you see the game in one box, then you see the fire in the other box. And I was glad they kept the game on, but I didn't feel like I needed to see the fire burning. right. I felt like I could see the game, but hey, at least they showed part of it.
Yeah, we're very concerned with the weather here, and it often interferes with sports broadcasts, I've noticed.
It does, especially if there's even a remote chance of a tornado or something, which thankfully we're not in that time right now, but there were some wildfires yesterday, and I think they got all that under control, but much needed rain on the way. Unfortunately, California, who also needed a lot of rain, got some, but now they're having some problems here. This is according to Reuters. Nearly 200,000 people are told to flee crumbling California dam spillway. Evacuation orders for nearly 200,000 people living below the tallest dam in the United States remained in place early on Monday after residents were abruptly told to flee when a spillway appeared in danger of collapse. Authorities issued the evacuation order on Sunday, saying that a crumbling emergency spillway on Lake Oroville Dam in North California could give way and unleash floodwaters onto rural communities along the Feather River. The dam, as mentioned, it's the highest in the United States, 770 feet, or 230 meters, if you prefer the meters. The structure was built between 1962 and 1968, the tallest U.S. dam, exceeding the Hoover Dam by more than 40 feet. So if that thing gives way, it's going to be some problems.
Yeah, talk about a life changer for those 200,000 people as well, having to evacuate like that. I don't know what they're doing in terms of their work and school situations, but that's obviously going to disrupt their everyday lives. Where are they going to live?
Right.
Where are you going to transplant 200,000 people who might not necessarily have extra money on hand to find a place to stay short term?
Right. And they some of the reports said they were in traffic for hours because everyone's getting out and the roadways get jammed. But that's a really good point. We had a few things happen here in central Oklahoma over the years. Mainly, I think, power outages that lasted several days and in the winter. And yeah, I remember when we had one a few years back that was a little longer lasting. That did start to come up. It's like, well, we can't stay in our house because it's cold. We don't have water unless you have a generator. Where do you go? Maybe a friend, hopefully. But if your friend doesn't have power, where do you go? And some people were having to go to hotels. But how long can you stay at a hotel before you're kind of out of money? So, yeah, that's a good question. So 200,000 people have to evacuate. And just wait and see what happens, I guess, throughout the day today, whether or not it gives way. If it does, it'll be interesting. And then, of course, there'd be some repairs there. Even if it doesn't give way, I think you'd want to get in there and fix it just to be on the safe side. So that'll be costly.
Yeah, exactly. It seemed like until recently, if that dam collapsed, at least there wouldn't have been much of a flood because they pretty much had empty dams across the state. But recently, they've been filling up a lot, so that could probably cause a lot more damage than it would have before.
Yeah, the on record, I was looking at the biggest loss of life from a dam breaking and giving way, and at least in modern times, 1975, it was in China, the Bangqiao and Shimantan dams. They gave way. Extreme rainfall beyond the planned design capability of the dam dumped on China by Typhoon Nina. 11 million people lost their homes, and the dam was later rebuilt, but 171,000 people died. So you do see that in some of those nations. China, of course, extremely high population, a lot of times packed together. You know, you'd wonder about the home quality and so forth, and then you have a dam give way like that. 11 million people lose their homes, 171,000 people killed. That was in 1975 in China, and that is the most catastrophic one on record that I could find.
Wow. Actually, I'm proud to say that I knew that hey. It was in China. For some reason, I would have guessed China, and I feel like I've vaguely heard about it being from China. Obviously, a terrible situation, though. And, of course, like you said, all of their elements there are geared toward them having the biggest disaster with all the people so close together in poor homes. And I don't know, they probably have more water in theirs than we might in a lot of ours.
There was, I think the second highest death count was from one in, I want to say Pakistan, somewhere in that area. So those areas do have, like you say, the conditions are right for problems.
Yeah, so 770 feet tall with the one in California. That's just massive. And you have obviously a lot of water pushing against it all the time. So you better hope that it's really strong.
Have you ever seen one of those big dams like the Hoover Dam?
I have from a distance. I forget which one it was. I feel like I was in the Southwest when I saw one, and I can't even remember which one it was.
Mm. Yeah, the Hoover Dam, you drive kind of around it on top of it, I guess, when you go into Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah, that's the one I saw.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
That's kind of like the gateway into Las Vegas in some ways. And it's really interesting history. From what I understand, there's dead people in there. I mean, you know, people were working on it and they fell in to the concrete and, well, nothing you can do. I mean, it's over. So they're still in there, I guess.
Yeah, that's kind of one of those things that we regret to talk about or to even we shudder to bring up because it happens all the time with some of these massive building projects throughout history. Like when we built the Panama Canal, plenty of people died from that too. And anytime you build some massive bridge or skyscraper, people almost have to die for it to even happen.
Yeah, I'm always amazed by the people that can do the high steel work.
Yeah.
And there's walking around up there and, that just, you got to have really good balance and, I don't know, not be afraid. You get paid well if you can do it.
Yeah.
But you'd have to have, I would psych myself out. I'd fall off the first day.
Yeah.
5 minutes in, I'd fall off. Terrible. High wire walkers. What do you call them? Trapeze? Is that right? Not trapeze. Sorry, tightrope walkers.
Yeah, that's
tightrope walkers. And they, I guess they did it for generations. It's kind of a family thing. And the one guy, he had done some pretty famous ones. Walked across a lot of like Niagara Falls and a few other things. And then they were trying this stunt and they fell. And I don't know if anybody died, but definitely got injured. Quite a few did. So. It was like this one, I think their family had done, they kind of pioneered it where they would stack a few of them on top of each other and walk across.
Oh.
They had done it successfully many times, but there's always a chance you're going to fall, and they did. So it takes a unique individual to do those sorts of things.
Yeah, it seems like if you had a job that dangerous, you'd want to make sure you've already done everything that you wanted to in life before you get into something like that. Otherwise, you die without having fulfilled all of your dreams and desires and goals. Speaking of dangerous jobs, there was a race car crash over the weekend in Las Vegas, and a couple of guys died from that, too. There's a lot of dangerous jobs, and I don't think we have anything near like that to worry about here.
Yeah, I guess there are certain jobs where going to work, you have to realize this could be it for me.
Yeah.
And I mean, really, police officer, firefighter, anybody that's doing anything that's daredevil type of work.
Bull riders, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those guys, they get impaled sometimes.
Yeah, It's amazing what some people will do. Even if you've ever gone to an NBA game, which I know you have, but the halftime acts.
Oh.
Some of those are very difficult and dangerous, and I imagine they just go city to city, and that's kind of their life. And I was wondering, well, how long can you keep it up? You know, you can't be doing it when you're too old, mm-hmm. just because of the strength. Like, there'll be people that are balancing or people that are doing flips, and one wrong move, and that's pretty much it. Or
yeah.
you're going to be injured, at least.
Yeah, I have a hard time watching a lot of the halftime shows at the Thunder games. There's always someone riding like a 75-foot-tall unicycle and balancing 13 plates on her head.
Yeah.
You watch because you can't look away,
yeah.
but you really wish you could.
Yeah, you don't want to, man. I can't even imagine if somebody, you know, fell and got hurt. It does happen very, very rarely, but it does happen. And I think it kind of stuns people. Like, they're not sure, was that supposed to happen? Because you don't expect it to happen. That happened famously or infamously in professional wrestling. One of those guys, Owen Hart, I think his name was. He was coming down from the rafters.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to lower him into the ring, and the thing gave way, and he fell to his death.
Yeah, he died in front of everyone,
in front
just watching.
Of everybody, yeah. And they just, you know, you kind of, it takes a second for everybody to figure out, wait a second, was that real? Because so much of it is a stunt show.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, it was an accident, and it killed the guy.
Well, yeah, a lot of those guys, they get slammed so hard, or they fall, and they act like they're totally still and dead for a couple minutes,
yes.
and then they finally get up when the match is over, but it would take a long time to figure out that he was playing around, or that he was not playing around.
Right, yeah. They must have some, I suppose the people producing the show know, obviously, like, wait a second,
yeah.
this isn't supposed to happen, but yeah, a lot of dangerous jobs out there. Speaking of sports, over the weekend, this is kind of interesting story. The USTA, which is the United States Tennis Association, they apologized after the Nazi-era German national anthem was played before the Germans had their matches. This is one of those. Germany has not been real happy with America lately on multiple levels, so this doesn't help. The U.S. Tennis Association has apologized to the German Fed Cup team for playing the Nazi-era national anthem ahead of a replay match in the women's tournament. Instead of the current version of the anthem, a singer performed verses of Das Deutschland Lied, which included the words Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles in der Welt. The version of the song used prior to and during Adolf Hitler's regime, the verses have developed a strong association with Nazi-era Germany. The words translate to Germany above all in the world. The USTA apologized afterwards, but some were still very upset. Speaking after her defeat in Hawaii, German team member Andrea Petkovic, who was born in Bosnia but grew up in Germany, said the mix-up was, quote, the worst thing that has ever happened in her life.
That's a good life, then.
Yeah, I was a little surprised she was that upset by it, but she said, I thought it was the epitome of ignorance, and I've never felt more disrespected in my whole life, let alone in Fed Cup, and I've played Fed Cup for 13 years now, and it is the worst thing that has ever happened to me. So, that's interesting. I don't know how many people would even notice that it was that song. Maybe they all do, I don't know, but I was a little surprised at how angry they were about it.
Yeah, same here. I just thought that there wouldn't be so much or so many parameters for playing a national anthem. I mean, just because some bad things happened during the time that national anthem was used, the anthem itself doesn't reference killing or anything like that. It sounds like pretty much every other national anthem where we say our country is the best, you know, basically everyone else should look to us as an example. That's and also, if you just listen to the two songs, the old national anthem sounds better than their newer one. That's just my opinion, I guess. But still, it doesn't seem like it's that serious of an issue.
Yeah, so she was really upset by it, and a few others were too from the German team. So, yeah, I'm a little surprised they were so upset, but that was kind of interesting.
Maybe if we were involved somehow,
yeah.
You know, what was that girl from Bosnia?
Mm-hmm.
Probably more directly impacted by something like that, I guess.
Yeah, so kind of interesting. I mean, I guess if they felt like she said she felt disrespected by it, like it was intentional or something, maybe maybe that would cause some problems. But like you said, if that's the worst thing that's ever happened to you in your life, eh, it wasn't a bad life.
Right.
So anyway, another reason for the Germany to be mad at the U.S., I guess, on a smaller scale.
We're having calls in America to change our national anthem, too, because apparently it's white supremacist.
Oh, really?
So
I haven't heard that. What do they want to change it to? Any ideas?
I don't know. They just don't like references to the Star Spangled Banner or, you know, the American flag in any way because they think it's racist somehow.
Mm, yeah. It always gets to be a bit of a dilemma.
Someone's going to be offended by every song, every flag, no matter what the case is.
Yeah, it's hard to please everybody, that's for sure. Here's an interesting one, pretty neat story here. A man's record running streak ends at 52 years, 39 days. So he didn't run for all that time, but he'd run every day. That's a long time to be running, and it wasn't just like a couple feet. He was running a mile at least every day.
Wow.
His name's Ron Hill. He's 78, a three-time Olympian for Great Britain. He ended his running streak on Sunday, January the 29th. It was the longest streak in the world, apparently, that anyone's keeping track of, you know. The streak during which Hill ran at least 1 mile every day had stood for 52 years, 39 days. It was the longest known running streak in history. So, I guess from time to time, you know, people like to run. Some are very consistent. Some are more up and down with it. It's easy to miss a couple of days here or there. And not this fellow, though. 52 years, 39 days.
You have to wonder if he has any cartilage left in his knees after all that wear and tear.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that he could do it. In a statement released by Streak Runners International, probably not what it sounds like, Hill, who lives in Hyde, a town a few miles from east of Manchester, wrote, "I have been having heart problems and have been waiting for some time now to have the problem diagnosed and hopefully rectified." On January 28th, Hill wrote he ran his last mile of the streak. He said, "After less than 400 meters, my heart started to hurt, and over the last 800 meters, the problem got worse and worse. I thought I might die, but just made it to 1 mile in 16 minutes and 34 seconds. Still faster than I can run a mile, by the way. There was no other option but to stop," he said. "I owed that to my wife, family, and friends, plus myself." So the heart's starting to give him some problems, and he thought, better stop now, or he's going to end up stopping for a long time.
Yeah, there's a danger to doing any exercise too much. Obviously, most people don't have that exact problem because, you know, we like to sit around in general. But I knew someone else who cracked his shins just from running all the time.
Really?
I mean, after a while, maybe your bones wear down. And if you're not, I don't know, drinking your milk or whatever else, it seems like that could happen.
Yeah, and it probably depends on a lot of things. Like you said, you know, your nutrition. Depends on where you run. You know, it's hard to run on asphalt.
Oh, yeah.
And it depends probably on your form. Sometimes people have pretty bad form. I don't know. I'm not an expert when it comes to running form, but I do see people kind of running around different places, and I think that doesn't look right. Stooped forward and kind of, you
right.
know. And it's so interesting. It's, you know, I think we're in a society of extremes, extreme weight loss, extreme exercise. And so you'll see people out, especially if it's a nice day. You'll see people out running, which is great. But you can tell those that are just starting because, you know, they're still quite, some cases, quite a bit overweight. And they're all geared up, and they've got all the stuff. But I always think you'd be better off probably just to start by walking, just because some cases, if you're carrying so much excess weight and all of a sudden it's like, hey, I'm going to run, you're not really ready to run. So I don't know if it helps or hurts more to do it that way, but I think you could get injured in those cases.
There's definitely an urge there to just say, I'm going to drastically change my health for the better right now. But a lot of the time, if you don't slowly ramp it up, then you're actually hurting yourself quite a lot.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the big things to be consistent in exercise that you need is something that's realistic. Because, you know, like you say, it's easy to say, from this day forward, I shall run 3 miles a day. And some people will, but a lot of people won't, you know. So it's good to do something a little more realistic and then build from there, I guess. And this guy was an Olympian. So, I mean, he was – used to running. It seems like he really enjoyed it. In 2014, when his streak hit 50 years, he told Runner's World, "I hope to live to 100 years and still be running." Over the first 50 years of the streak, he averaged more than 7 miles per day.
Mm.
So he was getting after it. But he had been running less, only about 25 miles per week in his mid-70s. What a slacker. That's a lot. 70s?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, still almost 4 miles a day.
Yeah, that's amazing. The streak was only one small accomplishment in his career. He competed in the Olympics in 64, 68, and 72. And they say, in fact, his disappointment in his performance in the 10,000 meters and marathon at the 64 games in Tokyo was what inspired him to begin the streak. He won the Boston Marathon in 1970 and set the record for the time, which has been beaten since. He was the second person to break the 2 hours and 10 minutes in the marathon, running a personal best of 2:09.28, and he held world records for 10 miles, 15 miles, and 25K on the roads. According to SRI, John Sutherland, 66, of West Hills, California, now holds the longest streak for consecutive days, running at 47 years and 8 months. So he's hot on his heels. He's got to keep doing it. Let's see, 66. So, yeah, he could pass him if he can stay healthy. And so that's, I guess this is kind of a thing among people. Maybe this will inspire somebody. Start your streak today.
Yeah, I wonder what they have to do to prove that they've been running every single day. I mean, anyone could say they've been running every day, but hopefully there's some way to prove it.
I don't know. Yeah, would you have to contact somebody and say, hey, I'm going to start the streak now. Keep your eyes out. I'll be out there. It sounds like, well, at least in the case of this gentleman, that Ron Hill, who just his streak ended. I mean, he was a very known and very famous runner. So I don't know if that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And because there would have to be a certain distance, obviously, you'd have to run. You couldn't say, you know, I'm going to run 20 feet a day. Well, sure. I mean, sometimes you have to get up and run to the restroom. I mean, I don't think that counts as part of the streak.
Exactly.
I was running to the fridge. I did it for 50 years in a row. It'd be interesting to see what the rules and regulations are there. But that's a pretty neat streak. And it's nice to see people, even as they get older, keep, you know, going after things. We had a little basketball drama over the weekend here in Oklahoma City. If you follow the Oklahoma City Thunder, you know that Kevin Durant left us and went to the Golden State Warriors. And so they played over the weekend, Saturday night, and it was their first time Golden State had played here and Durant had come back to Oklahoma City. So a little bit of a heated game. Golden State won pretty easily. They have the better team at this point. Westbrook played pretty well, a little bit heated. Well, there was drama off the court as well. Mahogany restaurant, which if you're in the local area, you've probably heard of, maybe been to. It's a really nice establishment. This weekend, Durant and his team were fresh off a defeat. That doesn't make sense. That's the wrong way to write that. They
fresh off a defeat of the Thunder.
This is what they said. Durant and his team were fresh off a defeat at the hand of the Oklahoma City Thunder. No, they beat the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Yeah.
Who writes it? This is from Fox News.
I don't get it.
Okay. Well, we'll sum it up for you.
Well, I'm glad that some people think the Thunder won.
Yeah. This guy needs to check out the score. The Thunder lost. Okay. According to Dave Osborne, the owner of Mahogany's downtown location, Durant had offered to rent out the restaurant on his own about 3 or 4 weeks ago. He wanted to rent out the whole thing. Him and his buddies could go there and enjoy some nice steak and so forth. The owner said, I thought about it, but I said, no, I can't do that because I have Thunder players that come in after games. Thunder players come in, fans come in, so I just said I can't do that to them. It wouldn't be fair. And they even mentioned this on the ABC ESPN showing of the game. They talked about this thing happening. But according to Osborne, Durant was not deterred. Shortly after declining the offer to rent out the eatery, which would have brought in between $30,000 and $35,000. Fair bit. The steakhouse owner received another call from the basketball star who allegedly said it would be totally okay with him if Thunder players were invited to join the post-game affair as well. And so ultimately they let Durant go to the steakhouse. Westbrook was also there, but they sat in different parts of the restaurant, and they did not speak to one another.
Yeah, so they didn't let Durant rent the place. Right. They just let them get a reservation like anyone else.
Yeah.
It's so funny that they were both in the restaurant.
The tensions run high.
Yeah.
It would have been interesting to be like the if you could wait on both tables.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put a bug in the other guy's ear. Hey, this is a note, you know, from Westbrook to talk to you.
Like fourth graders.
Yeah.
Sending each other notes.
My friend told me that they don't like each other.
No.
And but they end up eating at the same restaurant, so interesting.
Yeah, it was funny because during that game, like going into a timeout, Westbrook looked at Durant and was yelling at him, "I'm coming, I'm coming." And Durant said, "But you're losing, though." And it's like, I don't know if Durant should have kept his mouth shut or not, but he needs to think about what he thinks is a priority. Mm. Clearly, he wants to win, but not conquer the obstacles in his way to win. Right. He wants to take the easiest path possible.
Yeah.
So him saying that Westbrook is losing, well, of course he's losing. You're on a team with four All-Stars. It's sure. absolutely ridiculous. It's never happened in history.
Yeah.
So I don't think he has much to say about that.
Yeah, I was watching just the tail end of it Saturday night. My son was there watching with me on TV, and I told him, I said, you know, the thing that people really respected about Michael Jordan was that the Pistons beat him in the playoffs. I don't know, it was 3 or 4 years in a row. It might have been four or more.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kept improving work. He didn't go join the Pistons.
No.
He beat them. And when he finally beat them, they never, you know, beat them again in any you know, series. And the Bulls went on to win, of course, 6 championships over the course of, I think it was 8 years. And so that people can respect that. You can respect somebody that fought the team. That's kind of the way it always went. You'd have the team that was really good, and then the up-and-comers would take a couple years, and then finally they'd beat the team that was the top, and then they would be the top for a while. And it was always fun to watch that process. But now when you have players that, well, I don't want to lose, you know, so I'm just going to go join the other team. I just don't respect that.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, a lot of NBA analysts are being dishonest about what Thunder fans are upset about. They're acting like they're upset just because he left. There are plenty of players who go to different teams, but what has never happened before is a superstar losing in the playoffs to a certain team, mostly his own fault. It was mostly his own fault the Thunder lost to them, and then he goes to them. It's never happened ever, and that's what people are upset about. I was fine with him choosing anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, fans pay their big salaries. They want to see guys compete. They don't want to see guys quit and take the path of least resistance.
Yeah, I mean, I think some sports analysts have mentioned this, but it'd be like, you know, in the 80s, the Celtics and the Lakers always had epic series. That would be like every year when one of them lost, they go join the other team. Larry Bird going and playing for the Lakers. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't even imagine it. It would never have happened.
Yeah.
And so it's just very strange to see that. I think what bothers people, those that are bothered by Durant's move, is like you said, that you want to see him overcome the obstacle,
yeah.
not join the other side.
I mean, it was clear to everyone which team had more talent in that series and should have won it, and they basically handed the victory to the Warriors. I mean, it's not like he thought he couldn't have won a championship with the Thunder. He clearly was in his own way of that goal.
And if you're in the local area and you get a chance to go to Mahogany, it's epically delicious, by
yeah.
the way.
It's actually just a couple blocks down the road from the Thunder Arena.
Yeah.
So that's why a lot of players go there after the game.
Yep. A couple of locations. There's one out by Quail Springs Mall, too. Mm. Delicious. Went there for my anniversary. It was tremendous.
I see it all the time. I still haven't gone yet.
Guys like me, it's a once-in-a-while situation.
<You're right. laughs>
Guys like Durant, they rent the restaurant.
Well, apparently, Westbrook goes there after most home games. It's like he has his private room there that's never occupied, so he can go there whenever he wants.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He has the money. I mean, that's a pretty cool thing if you can do it.
Yeah, well, eat up. Enjoy it. After all the energy he expends, I imagine a nice meal is pretty good. Well, I didn't watch any of the Grammys. I'm not really interested, nor do I know who's popular these days, outside of maybe a couple of top people. But this headline caught my attention. A singer that I'm not familiar with, but the name is Joy Villa. Her music sales skyrocket after she wore a pro-Trump dress to the Grammys. I don't know if you saw this. She had this dress on. It was basically an American flag sort of on the back, and that said, "Make America Great Again" down the side. And wear that to the Grammys. That's a pretty bold statement because that's not a popular message. She's 25 years old, and her EP, I Make the Static, jumped to the top of Amazon's top digital paid albums and reached number 7 on the iTunes top album chart after her red carpet appearance. So it worked as far as marketing. The singer explained her controversial look on Instagram. She said, "Go big or go home. You can either stand for what you believe or fall for what you don't." Seems like I've heard those sayings before somewhere. Above all, she said, "Make a choice for tolerance and love. Agree to disagree." And some people criticized her and said she was only out for the attention. Which, yes, that's what stars are out for, attention. That's what they do.
Their whole career, basically. Yeah, well, it seems like people should not be criticizing her if they heap praise on someone else for expressing their views. The thing is, the media agrees with the views of most celebrities, and so they flaunt it as if it's the best thing ever. They don't like it so much when there's one person actually supporting Mr. Trump. I actually was expecting her to get attacked in some way because it seems like that's how the left always responds.
Yeah, I would have seen it fitting at like the Country Music Awards a little more, but yeah. The Grammys not so much. But anyway, she did it, and it helped her album sales a little bit. If you were listening to KPCG today, you've probably heard the new episode of Just the Best Literature with your host, Dennis Leap. And he's talking about the book H is for Hawk, which talks about a few things, but also some things about bird watching. And related to that, I thought this was kind of a neat story. A blind bird watcher sees with sound. There's a lot of people that like to go watch birds. And so does this guy, but he just can't see.
Oh.
His name is Juan Pablo Colasso. He's a bird watcher in Uruguay. He doesn't see birds the way that most bird watchers do because, of course, he is blind. He doesn't see them at all. He was born without sight. He listens to the birds and has developed a keen ability to identify their distinct calls and melodies. You know, probably to a point that would be easy for most of us. But then once you get more specific, it would get harder. You know, we can all tell, like, hey, that's a crow, but that's a rooster. But once you get more specific, it would be difficult. He has also embarked on a quest to record their sounds to help conserve his country's natural heritage in an audio archive. So it is interesting when you see people that have a handicap of some kind, but they're still getting out and enjoying certain things that you'd think they wouldn't be interested in. But he's learned to appreciate the sounds. And, you know, on a nice summer day or a spring day, all of us, and you wake up and hear the birds chirping, it's a very pleasant sound.
Yeah, and I bet he could probably put all of us to shame just by listening to birds. Even if we could see them and hear them, he probably can identify them better. And also, a blind person who was born that way wouldn't necessarily know what he was missing out on. So that's probably a better situation for him.
Yeah, that's true. It is amazing when people lose one of their senses, how the other senses pick up the slack. And, you know, all of a sudden, because they're focusing on hearing, they can really hear things that most of us probably don't hear. That is always kind of amazing to see how the body can compensate for those things. So he's out there bird watching. So we had some good stories today. A guy that's super old and was still running, and I shouldn't say super old, but as far as running that far, was a little older.
Not too many 78-year-olds who run every single day for miles.
And then the blind bird watcher, so that's good. A couple of inspiring ones, because there's always, unfortunately, some ones that aren't so great. So, of course, this one happened. There's been, I don't know, it seems like alligators are just in the news more these days. I don't know why, but a golfer uses a putter to fight gator at Magnolia Landing Golf Course. North Fort Myers resident Tony Ertz used his Cleveland golf putter to subdue a 10-foot gator that attacked him Wednesday as he was approaching the fourth hole at Magnolia Landing Golf and Country Club. So there's been stories recently about people golfing and the gators walking across the course. Pictures have been on the news. So they're out there. He says, as I was walking about 5 to 6 feet away from the water, I heard a splash. And as soon as I heard that splash, I knew it was an alligator, and he got me. The gator grabbed him by his right ankle, and he wound up on his back and was rolled into the nearby water hazard as they struggled. Nobody thinks you're going to die in the water hazard. You don't go golfing and think, I hope I don't die in that water hazard today.
Usually the water hazards aren't too deep either. Usually.
Usually.
So, but if there's a gator in there, that changes the whole story.
Oh, sure. He says, I remember having a club in my hand, and as soon as he had me in the water up to my waist, I started hitting him over the head. The gator didn't give up easily, and soon the water was up to his chest. He was looking at me with his big eyes, and I kept hitting him, Art said. And I'm thinking, I'm getting deeper and deeper, and I thought, you're not going to get me. So he made a change of strategy. He decided to start hitting him in the eye socket.
Oh.
Got to do what you got to do.
That's true.
He says, I hit him three times, and he let go of my foot, so I crawled back out. And by that time, the guys were there. And by guys, he means the officers from the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. And they captured the gator and put it down. Art had been living in Florida, has been living in Florida for more than 35 years and has seen plenty of gators, just not this close. He says, it's a good thing I had the putter. It was a good, solid, heavy putter. So you never know. If you find yourself in that situation, man, go for the eye socket.
Yeah, eyes are very sensitive. That's why if we get hit anywhere, that's probably one of the first places you'd like to avoid if possible.
Yeah.
Very sensitive.
So, I mean, I think that's kind of the way the alligators kill. They drowned at whatever they're going after, and then they eat it, I guess.
Yeah, they just clamp on. They don't let go, and then they pull you into deep water.
Yeah, roll you around.
Because obviously it's a lot easier to eat something that's already drowned and dead than trying to keep on biting it while it's fighting back so hard.
Yeah. I mean, so this guy's got an epic story now. He can always tell. But imagine if he had been killed. You know, you'd be thinking to yourself, oh, come on, this is the way I go? Alligator on a golf course?
Yeah.
I don't know if people, you know, before death, if they have those moments of like, well, so this is it. This is the way it goes down, you know? I suppose, you know, if you have an illness or something, you kind of realize that. But some of these freakish sort of events, I mean, it would be so interesting to see, like, the strangest ways people have died historically. They did have that show for a while. I forget it was on Spike or something about the weird ways people died.
Yeah, they're all true stories. And it's like they're all that would never happen to me type stories.
Yeah.
And yet they happen all the time. Thankfully, never to us yet, but still, it's amazing how those things can actually happen.
Yeah. Life's fragile. I mean, even you just watch the news and car accidents, you know, probably almost every day there's a car accident, a fatality.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, wow, you know, it's people are just going about their business. They don't expect anything to happen. All of a sudden, something does happen. So, yeah. But yeah, you don't expect an alligator on the golf course. So I think that would be one of the worst ways to go would be at the hands of some sort of a beast.
Mm-hmm.
Hands. The jaws of some sort of a beast because, yeah, you can't reason with him. You can't talk to him.
No.
Hey, come on. I'll buy you a burger. We can make a swap here. He's just looking at you. Go after the eye socket. If the guy didn't have that putter with him, he'd probably be dead.
Probably. Unless he thought to punch him in the eye socket, but that probably wouldn't have made as much of an impact.
Yeah, wouldn't have been as effective. He probably couldn't have reached down there either.
Yeah.
So that putter helped. Well, I see people, you know, we have people that walk around our neighborhood quite a bit, and sometimes people will take golf clubs with them, you know, just in case a dog comes out or something. So, yeah, you can get a good swing in with one of those.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's pretty smart. The animal has what's coming to him if he decides to attack like that.
Yeah. And in most cases, in my neighborhood anyway, most of the dogs are kept, you know, in a nice look, you know, they're kept behind a fence and they're fairly friendly, but you get some strays once in a while, you know, kind of mangy looking, come rolling in, and you know, sometimes they travel in packs, and that's when you got to be a little bit nervous.
They act on instinct. You never know exactly what instinct will tell them to do. It's very unpredictable. Why animals make me uneasy. I like to view them from a distance where I know that they can't possibly come at me.
Yeah, that would be a great show for you, a TV show. Why Animals Make Me Uneasy with Grant Turgeon.
I think I'd make it clear and everyone else would then be afraid of them.
They just bring on random animals and watch the two of you interact. He's uneasy about this one.
I would need to get paid a lot for something like that.
Yeah, make sure you had all your shots just in case. Key of David program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG today. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, back in the Ed Stone studios after a few days off. Make sure you catch up with that. Lots of headlines from over the weekend that he talks about. And thetrumpet.com as well. Make sure you check that out today. Here are some of the headlines that are at thetrumpet.com. how Russia became the Middle East's new power broker. Hamas insists ties with Iran strong despite regional polarization. The French election is now Marine Le Pen's versus a collapsing French establishment. And reaching for the bomb from German foreign policy. Also an analysis piece. Trump tells Germany, take control. The pressure is building up against Germany and will force it to aggressively pursue its own interests for the first time since World War II. So that is the analysis piece at thetrumpet.com today. Make sure you check that out along with the other headlines. Here's a story from Reuters. Talks about what happened over the weekend. New nuclear-capable missile test, a success, North Korea says. North Korea never admits failure. They're always having successful launches.
That is true. And then it's funny because an outsider will say, well, no, it went 10 feet and plopped right into the water. Not that successful. But apparently the North Koreans think if it gets off the ground at all, it was successful.
They claim success. North Korea said on Monday it had successfully test-fired a new type of medium to long-range ballistic missile the previous day, claiming advances in a weapons program it is pursuing in violation of UN resolutions. North Korea fired the missile on a high arc into the sea early on Sunday, the first probe of U.S. President Donald Trump's vow to get tough on an isolated island regime that tested nuclear devices and ballistic missiles last year at an unprecedented rate. So anytime a new administration comes in, some of these groups like to test them and see what they'll do about it. The Norse state-run KCNA news agency said leader Kim Jong-un supervised a test of the, boy, this is going to be a tough one, Pugasong-2, sorry, North Korea.
Fair attempt. Right.
A new type of strategic weapon capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. It's always interesting. You always see Kim Jong-un supervising. He's always pointing at something, and I think we all know he doesn't know what's happening. I'm pretty sure he's not the mastermind behind the missiles. But
yeah, probably the only thing he does is just execute a scientist if he doesn't make the perfect missile. That's the only thing he knows about.
Yeah, it's interesting when you see the footage of that. Everyone always looks really nervous.
Yeah, it better be successful.
Because, yeah, if he deems that you're not needed, you're not needed anymore.
Yeah.
So
and death would be better than the internment camps they have or whatever, those labor camps.
Yeah. Bad situation over there in North Korea. North Korea has conducted 5 nuclear tests, including 2 last year, although its claims to be able to miniaturize a nuclear weapon to be mounted on a missile have never been verified independently. So you never really know exactly what's going on. Leader Kim said in his New Year's speech, the North was close to test launching an intercontinental ballistic missile. And state media have said such a launch could come at any time. If they actually had a fully developed ICBM, it could threaten the continental United States, about 9,000 kilometers, 5,500 miles from North Korea. So they always say they're going to do that or they have the capability to do that, but it's never been independently verified. It's hard to know what North Korea is doing, but they're causing trouble, if nothing else, getting themselves into the headlines. I'm spending some money on this, I guess, while the people starve.
Yeah, it's North Korea is a weird situation, and it could be a pretty big threat to America, especially when they basically have the tacit backing of China, and Russia seems to support them as much undercover as they can. Russia recently had that Satan 2 missile that they developed, which can avoid anti-missile systems. So if they happen to lend one of those to North Korea, Russia could say, well, we didn't shoot it off at you, America. You know, there are a lot of dangers there. And I've always wondered over the years, too, why we never really did much about places like Cuba or North Korea. I know they have some backing, but what is someone going to do if we topple those regimes? The people are completely miserable and they're being tortured.
Yeah, it's really it'd be interesting to kind of see all the talk behind the scenes that never gets out to the media, like what people are like, the leaders really talk about or why they do certain things. It'd be fascinating to see, because I'm sure, like, even President Trump, I'm sure, you know, they campaign and they say certain things, and then you get into office and you get a little more information probably about a few things and you go, oh, okay.
Yeah,
I kind of see why maybe we would do this or that.
Right.
Be a little more strategic than then they would know going into it. But yeah, obviously North Korea, you could easily overrun them. It wouldn't take much at this point, I don't think. But anyway, they're content to let them sit there and cause trouble.
They're technically still at war with South Korea too, I'm pretty sure. They never really signed a peace treaty at the end of that. So that's why they're so hostile toward them still. They still consider themselves arch enemies of South Korea, at war with them still.
Yeah, they always, you go to a news site or something, website, and they always have those, they call them clickbait, at the bottom, like, look at these 10 pictures of, whatever. And I usually don't care too much about those, knowing that they're just clickbait. But whenever they say, pictures from inside North Korea, I'm always like, oh, I always look at those.
Can't resist those.
Yeah. Nobody knows what it's like in there.
I've tried to look up things about North Korea just because they are so secretive. It just naturally makes everyone want to know more about them, which is the exact opposite of what they want.
Yeah, the government really does have to control, say, information from the West, because they'd realize pretty quickly, like, wait a second, it's a lot. We have a lot worse than we thought we did. We thought we were living in the communist paradise. Turns out that's not the case.
Exactly. A lot of them are just completely brainwashed, and there's that campaign as well from South Korea where they basically send those information balloons over the border, and hopefully someone finds them, but obviously a lot of soldiers shoot them down and destroy them first. The people just have no idea what's outside of their borders, and so it's hard to really free people like that if they don't really think they need to be freed.
Yeah, really interesting situation over there. You've got an article for us here, Grant. This is a meeting going on Monday today. Trump set to meet Canada's Trudeau at the White House. This should be a little bit awkward. Pretty different ideologies here.
This is no longer Mr. Trudeau's good friend, Mr. Obama, in office. So things could be pretty awkward. It would seem like it would be much like Mr. Obama and Mr. Trump meeting pretty soon after Mr. Trump was elected, where they spoke for an hour and a half. They seemed to get along pretty well. But obviously, Mr. Obama had just campaigned against him. So that's going to be a very awkward meeting. And this is pretty much the same, where Mr. Obama was Mr. Trudeau's mentor. So he's probably going to be thinking the same exact things. This is Mr. Trump's third meeting with a foreign head of state, following meetings with the British and the Japanese leaders. And he's also meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday. But before that, today he's meeting with the Canadian leader, Justin Trudeau. Very, very different ideologies and worldviews. Mr. Trump is more conservative, if you can call it that. Mr. Trudeau is about as liberal as it gets. Just complete ideological opposites. There are actually some ways, though, where these two countries could see eye to eye, namely the Keystone XL pipeline. Canada was always in favor of that, while Mr. Obama didn't like it. Basically, it would benefit Canada so much economically that even all of their hippies and environmentalists couldn't be heard there. They had to have that oil pipeline. But Mr. Obama, obviously, America doesn't need it as much, and so Mr. Obama listened to the environmentalists here and didn't want that pipeline to go through, whereas Mr. Trump does. That would actually work in Canada's best interests.
Yeah, the little bit I saw about this meeting today was they thought that Trudeau was going to focus on trade and try to keep it, focus more on the economics than maybe some of their other differences, because obviously they would have quite a few differences probably beyond that. But typically, you can come to some sort of a common ground on making money, if nothing else.
Exactly. That's where really Mr. Trudeau should be thankful, because in a lot of ways, Mr. Trump would try to do things favorable for America, but also things that would work out for the person he's doing business with. Obviously, he wants to dismantle the North American Free Trade Agreement, I believe it's called, basically because America was getting the short end of the bargain there with Canada and Mexico. But I believe he would probably try to rewrite something in a relatively fair way. Also, some of their disagreements, it might just be better off not talking about for those two, because they have just totally different ideas about immigration. I believe it was 2 days after Mr. Trump signed that immigration moratorium from those seven terrorist-heavy countries, that Mr. Trudeau tweeted about how Canadians will welcome you regardless of your faith. He said, "Diversity is our strength. Welcome to Canada." Obviously, that's in direct opposition to Mr. Trump. That's something where they would probably have a really heated disagreement, maybe just better off not talking about.
Yeah. Well, or maybe come to an agreement. Like, well, we don't want people coming into our country illegally, but if you don't mind, we'll shuttle them all the way up there. If you want to pay for it, we'll put them on buses and we'll drive them all the way up into Canada. That'd be fine.
Yeah, we'll see how serious Mr. Trudeau is about that, because if he's willing to take all the ones who are trying to get into America, then we know he's serious.
Yeah. Well, and they do. I mean, it is very mixed up there in Canada, especially in the big city centers. I mean, there's all sorts of different races. So, I mean, I think they really do let a lot of people come through. But they've had problems, too, you know, with that to some extent. Over the last few years, there's been a few there's been a few problems with some of that immigration. I saw today that Pakistan is sending a lot of the immigrants out of their country, I believe. And, you know, so countries are, I mean, around the world are really starting to say, hey, we're not just going to let anybody come into our borders anymore. But still, the U.S. is the main focus on that issue. But if you look at what Germany, I mean, even Angela Merkel now is talking about paying people to leave. So, I mean, people are starting to say, hey, we do need to kind of solidify our borders. It's not just the U.S.
Japan is accepting nobody. Where is the outcry there?
Right.
They don't want a single one of those people coming in and burdening the system and possibly committing crimes. They don't want that at all. So they took the common sense measure that put their own people first. That's what the governments of these different nations are supposed to be doing. They're not supposed to be running a charity for the entire rest of the world within their own borders.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. And yet people like Mr. Trudeau are totally fine with it. In 2015, he visited an airport in Toronto where a plane load of Syrian refugees had just landed, and he personally greeted them and welcomed them. For all he knows, some of those people are diametrically opposed to the way of life in Canada. Although Canada is pretty extreme compared to here, I heard a couple of conservative commentators talking about how there are entire schools that speak various Asian languages. They don't speak English in the school. And even after 9/11, a lot of the Muslim immigrants in some of the schools were cheering the attack. And every single one of them absolutely hates the Jews. I mean, they're vocal about it there. Those are not the types of people that you can just think you can peacefully coexist with. And the Asians don't really, in general, they don't cause too many problems. But the fact that they're allowing schools there that don't speak the language, it's like you're balkanizing your own country. You're having these pockets where I'll just go here, I'll just go here, I'll avoid those spots. They're like countries within a country, and that can't really work.
No, it can't. And I suppose maybe for a time it seems okay if the economy's good and everybody's got some, you know, money and such. But when you're that divided in such key areas, if you start to have economic problems, it's going to be a bad deal, because, you know, everyone's going to fight for themselves and they're going to band together. And so, yeah, that'll be interesting. So that meeting is set for today. President Trump set to meet Candace Trudeau at the White House. Always interesting to see the handshakes and the pictures, because leaders, they don't always agree, but they've got, I guess, kind of smile for the camera.
For the most part, they have to put on a fake happy face and pretend like there's peace among them, when a lot of the time, probably privately, they're expressing hatred for each other. So it's quite a tricky game, politics. It just, people are always, they're pretending to be what they aren't just for the sake of being diplomatic and hoping that you can advance your nation's interests, sometimes at the expense of some of your enemies. A lot of other disagreements that these two leaders might have are on climate change and economic policy. Obviously, on economic policy, I mean, Mr. Trudeau's dad is a great friend of the Cubans, you know, the Cuban regime, not the people. and little Justin was going down there with his dad on many trips. So his dad actually is very extreme in that way, and he actually instituted martial law while he was in charge of Canada, I believe. So very extreme. He pretty much has a lot of the dictatorial tendencies of the Cuban regime, and so he probably passed that on to his son. Not something that Mr. Trump would necessarily agree with.
If you want to learn more about Mr. Trudeau and some of his ideologies, which, because, you know, I hadn't heard too much about him here until he came into power, but there's some good write-ups at thetrumpet.com about that, and I think Robert Morley wrote those, and he's from Canada, so he has some of that personal history and as well as good research on it. So that'll be an interesting meeting today. You know, and too, on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Stephen Fleury was talking about a write-up that I saw over the weekend as well on the fact that President Obama said he's going to, you know, come back here pretty soon. He's going to set up his home base about 2 miles from the White House, and he's using a lot of nonprofits to kind of oppose the Trump administration. So you have to wonder if somebody comes in, like, say, Mr. Trudeau, and you have the former president set up just a couple miles from there, does he make a visit over there too?
It would seem like it.
It seems like he's setting up a little bit of a shadow government there in the shadow of the White House.
Isn't that what they called it, the shadow White House?
I think so.
Yeah, that is just really beyond what he was ever asked to do by the American people. And just like the American people got sick of a lot of these liberal, radical leftist policies, the Canadian people are getting sick of the way Mr. Trudeau is doing things as well. The thing is, with these liberal ideas, they sound great. The vision can get you swept up emotionally, but you can't put it into practice. There are no practical applications for these ideas. Obviously, the American people rejected their radical left leader. It seems like Mr. Trudeau is going to cause a massive swing back to the conservative side for the Canadians as well. But he's still in power now. He's going to be meeting Mr. Trump today, and we'll just have to see what happens there.
Yeah, be really interesting. So we'll be more updates about that on thetrumpet.com and, of course, kpcg.fm. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon, thanks for joining us here on this Monday. Have a great rest of your Monday, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.